Hi, everybody. This is Steve Savitsky, and welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And I'm here with Rabbi Alex Ozar. Hi, how are you, Rabbi Ozar?
Hi, Steve. I'm doing great. Thank you very
much. That's really great. Well, you know, we're here to talk about your incredible article that you wrote, which has gotten a lot of publicity now, Headaches and Head Coverings. And it's gotten, you know, it's, I don't think we'd say it's gone viral, but it's gone pretty far. So first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself. I don't really know you. We've never met. So where do you live and what do you do, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, it's good to meet you now. I am Alex Ozar. I graduated YU a few years ago with a degree in philosophy and a master's in Jewish philosophy and just finished Smicha there. I'm currently pursuing a PhD at Yale in philosophy of religion. That's my full-time occupation these days. I'm a philosophy student.
Interesting. Really interesting. Philosophy student. Yeah.
Yes, now I'll tell you, I work in a field where you work for months and months producing articles or books or whatever it is, and you pour everything you have into it, and you have only just the faintest vague hope that maybe 3 to 5 people in your field will have the time to look at it at some point. So to have written something that so many people read and commented on was really exciting. It was a new experience.
I know. It is exciting, and it's very interesting. And we, of course, at the OU are very appreciative that, you know, we put it up on our website, and we've gotten a lot of hits on it. And so why did you decide to write this article to begin with?
That's a good question. I mean, the first thing I would say is just that the article is an exercise in Talmud Torah, and Talmud Torah doesn't really require any explanation. But it would be fair to ask why this specific topic. I'm in a stage of life now in my late 20s. I got married recently, and a lot of my friends have been getting married over the last few years. And I'm just seeing and observing and talking to and being with so many women and people that they're connected with who are just entering this new, what turned out to be huge, sometimes burdensome, but always just huge, massive, massively imposing world of hair covering. And it's something that, especially for people who didn't grow up with it, but even for people who did, it's just a huge change and a huge transition that people go through from one day to the next. There's one day where this area of your life does not exist, and the next day in which it does, and it starts to define and control everything that you do throughout your day. And my feeling was that for a lot of people, even people who are totally devoted to it, were embracing it wholeheartedly, the feeling was that a lot of people, there was a pretty severe thirst and desire just to have a greater sense of understanding and command of what the sources were, where these things were actually coming from, and just to have a more textured sense of what the parameters are and a way to engage the mitzvah more substantially. And then let's put very generally. And it turned out also that there are a lot of people for whom it's very difficult. It was extremely hard sometimes for the reasons I said, which were really just physiological issues, and there can be all sorts of reasons why picking this up and adopting this mitzvah is just a huge challenge.
So let me ask you this question, then Rabbi Ozar. So first, let's go back to the source. I mean, you know, you say, you know, you want to write for Torah, and I read your piece. It's beautiful. So let's talk about it. A lot of people ask, what is the reason that women are asked to cover their hair? Is it a deraisa? You say it could be. Most people see it is, or the derabbanan. What are the sources, et cetera, et cetera? Let's try to do it succinctly if we can.
Okay, let's try. The Gemara in Ketubos on Daf Ayin Beis, I believe, Ayin Aleph, quotes the source has to do with the image of the Sota and the Beis Mikdash, a woman who is accused of adultery, and there's a ritual to verify her status. And one of the things that we do as part of the humiliation of the Sota is so that we uncover her hair. And from there, the Gemara infers that it must be that, in fact, women are generally obligated to have their hair covered. From the course of the discussion in the Gemara, it appears, the way it's formulated, that this is a diuresa obligation. That, however, becomes complicated. There are, and we, this is not the forum to go through all the details and derivations, but there are reasons to think that it may be globally, actually, derabanan, rabbinic construction. And within the question of it, even within the claim that it would be diuresa, there's also room to ask whether this is what we would call a lotase, an actual prohibition that one may not go out without their hair covered, or a positive injunction. Not that it's forbidden not to, but that you are obligated to. And that will also have some ramifications for how we process the obligation in our lives.
Okay, so now when you go back over time and you look at, let's say, generations years and years ago, we're making an assumption that women did cover their hair. I mean, let's say in the time of Rashi or Rabbeinu Tam or the Vilna Gaon. I mean, do we have any sources to show that women actually did cover their hair at those days?
There certainly are. And the basis of the Gemara's derivation is the observation that women, in fact, did cover their hair. And I mean, throughout medieval literature and the medieval halachic literature, it is clear that the majority of women did cover their hair. Sometimes a lot further and more depth than we would ever see in our day. So Rishonim living in Sephardic countries, in Arabic lands, where, as we know, still until today, the universal custom among everybody, not just Jews, was that women would be fully covered, their entire bodies, their entire hairs, and sometimes their faces. That was also prevalent. It's really only in the modern period, and in most, especially Western Europe, and then slowly into Eastern Europe, as the process of modernization developed, that it became less of, the practice was less prevalent in the world community period in society and culture, and then it slowly became something that was less common even in strictly traditional circles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So getting back to that, that same kind of question in a way. So today we have a world where we have the most beautiful shetels in the world, unbelievably expensive. It's you see them advertised all over. Is it really the same purpose of covering the hair? Is it having a woman now who wears a shetel that's absolutely fantastic, probably makes her look nicer even than regular hair?
Right.
Is that are we defeating the whole purpose, or is it still valid even though the shetel is not the little, you know, head covering that we would expect?
Right, it's a really important question. First of all, there are substantial bodies of authority that even today will say that shetels are strictly forbidden, and precisely that reason, that the idea is outrageous, that you would cover something with the very thing that you're supposed to be covering. It's inherently silly. But I think it has become, if not universal, it's become standard in Ashkenazi communities to wear shetels, and for that to be legitimate. But I would say, and this is part of the broader point, so the broader halachic point that I was trying to make in this article, is that on all views, hair covering is never a single factor obligation. It is never enough in determining what the obligation is to ask the single question, is the hair covered or is it not? Because the question is always contextual. The question is not only is the hair covered, but is the hair covered and where is the person? And that was the parameter I was looking at, but there are others. And the broader point is that uncovered hair cannot be strictly identified as nakedness in the way that, say, we'll talk about the torso or the thigh, which are considered absolutely, objectively, strictly always forbidden to have uncovered. The hair is, I'll put it this way, the obligation for a woman to cover their hair is necessarily part of a fuller, holistic, contextually rich statement of modesty and identification. And so a woman covering her hair with a shetel, first of all, the hair is covered, bottom line, just the letter of law is covered. And then you have this secondary question, but is this really in the spirit of the law? Is this really modest? She's covering her hair with things. And I think the answer is that in those communities where this is seen as valid and this is the way things are done, then that becomes the contextual, holistic form of modesty and identification as one of the daughters of Israel, because that is how the daughters of Israel cover their hair. And wearing a shetel nowadays is every bit as much that statement as covering your hair another way. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, no, I think it makes some sense. I mean, it's a difficult question, but let's get back to your article, okay? So headaches and head coverings. First of all, I thought it was very interesting. You said something that I really, really liked a lot. You said a lot of things, but you said something that I really thought was really, really great. You talked about the fact that this is not an epidemic. In other words, you know, you're saying, look, there are women out there who definitely, it's uncomfortable. Perhaps there are some women who get migraine headaches. These are issues, but it's not an epidemic. But sometimes non-sensational problems deserve our attention too. I really, really love that, because so many times in the Jewish world, I find that the crisis of the day is what we look for. What is the new crisis? And this is not a crisis, but it's an issue. It's an issue. It's an issue for some women. I'm sure that Rabbanim have dealt with it. And so I really thought you brought it up and you expressed it really in a very beautiful way. So maybe you want to comment on that.
It was really wonderful. As I said before, it was surprising and really wonderful. And just, I was just so happy that the amount of responses I got and just the quality of the responses, where there were so many people who just said, thank you, this was a helpful, interesting discussion, and thank you for talking about this in a helpful way. And I think there was really, I don't want to make myself out to be amazing, but I think there just is a powerful thirst among people in our community for healthy discussion of important things. And we all get dragged into the big ticket headline sensationalist things, and that's sort of the logic of where the media and the internet always goes, and where we wind up spending a lot of our time. But this, I think, this helps cement in my mind that people in our community really are really robustly capable of having healthy, good conversations about everyday things, and advancing discussions about everyday things, and that people really want to. There's really a hunger for that, which was...
Right, and that everything is a part of Torah and Jewish life, and that, you know, there are issues that have to be discussed, and you hit on an important topic that's never, ever really spoken about. And that's why I think people really responded to the article. And I mean, I know you got obviously some calls from people who were saying thank you for writing the article. Did you get any negative calls from people who thought you brought something up that you shouldn't have brought up?
I thought there were some negative responses. Mostly there was, I'd say, some skepticism about whether I was making a mountain out of a molehill. Is this really a problem? Are there really, how many women are there actually for whom this is an issue? And generally, there's any time that you are promoting a view that could lead to kula about important things, to leniency, then people get suspicious that there's an ulterior agenda going on. You're really trying to subvert the general practice. You're trying to cut things down. But even that was very light. Very easy to respond to, just by saying that, in fact, there are people for whom this is an issue.
Well, look, I thought also, by the way, what was also interesting was that, you know, you're talking about the various places where, even if a woman does cover her hair, there are places in her house or maybe in the courtyard or other places where perhaps, you know, it's not as stringent. And that's something also which is an important point, and I think that you brought up and furthers discussion, and I think people are going to be talking to their rabbis about this, which is good.
Right. And that's really all. I would be surprised if even one person read this article and changed their practice based on just reading this article. And I would also say that would be, that is absolutely not how this should go. People should in the ideal world, people would read it, they would have ideas and questions, and then they would speak to their family and to their rabbis and think through themselves how they this should issue in practice. But the point is that people, the hope is that people will have better questions to ask, and they'll have better ideas in thinking these things through, and they'll have a vocabulary to be able to think these things through intelligently and better informed.
And maybe even, I thought about this, but maybe even the people who actually make, the wigs, the shetlos, maybe they're going to start to think about, could we find a way of making one which is lighter, which is more eerie, which is, easier, so that you maybe it's not going to be so constricting and perhaps
I knew nothing about this until very recently, but it turns out there is actually a pretty huge industry doing just that. And I never would have known. And I think that these things are discussed very widely outside of the small community of women, the clubhouse of women who cover their hair, in which these things are talked about endlessly. But the rest of us wouldn't necessarily know. But there is actually a huge burgeoning industry of people doing just that, people trying to design shetels and other forms of artificial hair coverings that are more comfortable. It can get more expensive, and there are different kinds of different approaches and different options. You have to know where to shop. It's a whole world you wouldn't have known about.
It's a whole world, the whole industry, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, so now that you've written this one, Headaches and Head Coverings, what are you on to next? Anything else that you think you may be writing about that is gonna create some buzz?
I think I've had enough buzz for the last few weeks.
You had enough buzz.
Okay. Try not to write directly for buzz. The other work that I do that is of some interest to our community is have a handful of papers that will be coming out the next few months on philosophical issues having to do with Zionism and Jewish sovereignty over the state
okay,
of Israel.
Great. Okay, great. Well, we're looking forward to reading it and to hearing from you. And
it's
really been a pleasure, Rabbi Ozar, to interview you. I know that people are going to be listening to this because they like the article, and I think it created a lot of thought. So thanks so much, and thank you so much for everything you do. Be well. Bye-bye.